Hi everyone, welcome to the Martial Way. My guest today began his martial arts journey at the age of 13 in Kenpo, moving to Kyokushin under Sensei Hiyoki, I believe, later with Shigeru Oyama, and going on to obtaining black belts in judo, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, tournament fighting, full contact champion, ultimately creating his own system, Tetsu Bushijitsu. I know I say this with everybody that comes on here, but it really is an honor. And, I just want to welcome everyone to Marco Lala.
Well, thank you. I didn't know, this makes me look really old, right? I'm going to take my glasses off if that's all right.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm going to be 55 in September. So,
man, you look great. You look great.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's, been quite, you know, about a year ago, you know, I'll get into it a little bit, but, but I'm completely just re-obsessed with everything that, you know, it's funny. There was a saying, like, you know, what would your 50 or 60-year-old self say to your 20-year-old self, right? Yeah. So I kind of flipped it. You know, I was just thinking the other day, it's like, what would my 20-year-old self tell my 50-year-old self, you know? And he would be like, you know what? Just F it, man. Just do it. What are you doing? Go get your dreams.
That's awesome.
And I think a lot of that's lost today. And,
it is. I believe so too.
So my 20-year-old self, and I'm seeing that through my son's eyes too, at 20, I have to bite my tongue a little bit because I want to keep him focused and disciplined. But I'm like, dude, you're 20 years old, man. Your whole life is ahead. Try this, do that, you know, just
life's,
as long as you,
life's a buffet.
Life's a buffet. But, I did actually, as I mentioned earlier, before during our warm up, I did a crash course on your podcast, and on my bike ride this morning, just yesterday and today, I'm back up to about 20, a little over 20 miles. I try to do that every morning.
Wow!
And it's a hack. I don't know if it's common knowledge, but you know, when you watch the YouTube, you put the speed on like 1.25 or 1.5. So I'm listening to all these guys at like 1.75. You know, Pettis, your instructor for Rossi,
really,
and
was really great training at Oyama.
I'm like, you know, it almost made him sound more Japanese. Actually, when I think about it. I was like, us, you know. So I just admire what these guys did, and you know, I was having flashbacks from you know, my training with Hiyoki and then Oyama.
All right, let's get into all that, because honestly, you've been giving flashbacks to people lately too, and we were talking about it off air a little bit. Like, I remember you coming up like in the ads. I remember the videos where you're doing the demos with Oyama.
Yes.
Like, just, man, you were, I'm telling you, I told you earlier, I get goosebumps. Like, your technique was incredible, probably still is, but your kicking, everything, just, man, you were you're a living legend, absolutely. I can't wait to get the story and
like we say, we're a legend in our own mind, right? But you know, that goes all to Sensei Hiyoki. I mean, you know, this guy was like the textbook of just, you know, the movements, the philosophy. You know, he never like separated. He's like, all right, you got to be a great fighter. You got to be strong. Your kata has to be impeccable. I'm like, us. You know, I had no idea what's going on. Whatever he said, you know, he used to say stuff like, you know, the samurai used to train longer than they slept. So I'm like, shit, I'm going to try that. So I would go to my backyard and I would pick a few katas and I tried to do them like throughout the whole night. Like, I'd not sleep. I remember waking up in my backyard in the grass. You know, my mother's like, what the hell are you doing in the backyard? I'm like, Mom, this is how has samurais trained. You know, they did it with the sword, you know, thousands of cuts, the same cut over and over again. So I always thought there would have been some magical achievement by, you know, by that dedication. And, you know, and just everything, he just exuded it. I mean, when I left Kenpo, I was young at the time. I was still in eighth grade. So that summer, I started, you know, when I went into high school, I started thinking to myself, right, I got to get serious. So I just went into the phone book. I looked up all schools. I jumped on a bus like the first time by myself, you know, 14-year-old kid. I'm going to all these dojos. Mm. And I went to this dojo and you know, I met the guy that owned the school. And then I think he must have been an Ushideshi, because he came on behalf of the Kyokushin organization. That's how these guys did it. That was their ticket to United States.
Right.
You know, there were Uchideshi in the headquarters that were like, the guy was an accountant. but he was an Uchideshi for 2 years, you know, so in order to get to America. So, so I was like, oh, you know, I saw like, you know, he showed me around the dressing rooms and I saw like a mattress, like leaning up against the wall. I'm like, no, that's impossible. Like, oh, so you live around here? He goes, yeah, I live here. I'm like, what? You know, he just, this is where I sleep. I just flipped the bed down. I'm like, holy shit. This is like what, that's what dedication, you know, as a young kid, you're like, wow, I guess that's what it takes to succeed in an area, whether it be martial arts or what have you. So, but you know, the, and then when we were doing tests and things, that's when Shigeru Soshi Oyama would come in. So that even put him up on even a higher pedestal because that was our instructor. And I'm like, all right, if I got to be good for Sensei Hiyoki, God, you know, God knows what kind of shape I got to be in when Oyama comes to the dojo. So it was, and every class was just, you know, we were talking about fighting and everything like that. It was just, you know, the business plan was, the model was a little weird because it was, you know, you trained for 2 or 3 hours, you know, there was beginners, intermediate, and advanced, each one was an hour. So at the end of the second class, which where everybody showed up, because that was the intermediate class, anytime you heard line up, you know, those magic words, line up. It's like, no, the class is not over. Now you're ready. Everybody's getting their ass kicked. So we would all, everybody would line up. And I swear to God, if there was 15, 20, 30, 40 people first, the instructor would just proceed to kick the shit out of everybody in the class, you know? And that was after, what we did was we lined up and then the, you know, lower belts, you'd fight the guy next to you. And then you would fight, that guy would fight the guy next to him and would go down the up the row. So imagine you're like the 33rd guy and you're watching like 20 fights, people, you know, broken rib or, you know, who's getting carried off the mat. And I'm like, you know, you're sweating, you're like, and you know, the guy you're fighting is right next to you and you're going to be doing that. You're watching this. And, then he would kind of like pit up, you know, like these, battles amongst the top students. He's like, you know, let's see how Marco's doing today. Let's put these like three brown belts up against them, you know, one right after the other, you know, and then after that, he would kick your ass. So it would just like people would leave. And I'm like, I don't know. That's not really a good business plan if you want to run a successful karate school. It's like, you know, we want the toughest people here. Like that philosophy is like, is insane, you know, when you think about it. But, you know, I'd go home, you know, I always say my mom's like, oh, how was class? You know, I'm like, you know, half. I never knew if I broke my ribs or not because I was always in pain. You know, your legs, you know, from the leg kicks, you're like, mom, the class was great. I can't wait to go back the next day. It's like, what are you talking about? So, but it was just, that's why, you know, like I said, when I was listening to, you know, Pettis and Reed and whatever, the training was just, you know, but here it was a little different. It was more self-induced. Like if you didn't want to do it, there was, you know, except for your instructor pushing you, it wasn't like you went outside and you know, you're talking to other people that train. He just thought you were from another planet. Like, oh yeah, hey guys, I got to go home. I got to do 2,000 sit-ups. I'll see you tomorrow. It's like, what are you talking about? Who does that shit, man? You know? So, it was an obsession. And, you know, frankly, and it's funny, you mentioned with the magazines and everything. I've been coming back into this. I mean, the emails and the texts and the posts that I'm getting is insane. I mean, I got guys like Marco. I was a teenager. One guy just told me he watched my knockout tape like 200 times in a row when he got it. Guys now that are about my age said that, you know, the older material influenced them when they were a teenager. You know, I studied a lot of, you know, marketing and mail order and things of that nature. You know, I tried to design my copy, but I was always afraid to make a real wild claim. Like even my video, how to knock out any attacker within seconds. Like I would have never done that if I didn't have a video showing me knocking people out, like in a tournament. Like I couldn't do like a death touch video, like because how do you demonstrate the death touch, right? So, you know, it was when my first product was actually my endurance training manual, phenomenal endurance training. And what happened is all my products were the result of a weakness that I had. I researched it and I tried and I cataloged it. I was almost like trying to create a time capsule encyclopedic note for myself for my future. It sounds crazy because maybe it was like you know, somewhat like I can feel it inside. There might've been a time maybe where there was going to be a gap of my serious karate training. And now having listened to those guys on your podcast, I can understand, because there's a point in time in your life, you're like, okay, do I eat? Do I raise a family? Am I going to get a job and things of that nature? You know, and I did some serious, you know, lateral moves. Mm-hmm. But so all those products, phenomenal endurance training. So the books were first. Mm-hmm. And then when I compiled, I had a list of a couple of thousand people. This was all on index cards in a plastic box, right? I was in printing. I studied marketing and so forth. So I won the 87 lightweight championship. And around 90, I'm running. I come home. There's a bubble envelope in the mail with a VHS tape with a handwritten thing, you know, 87 tournament. I'm like, what the hell is this? It was the whole tournament, it, you know, videotaped. And I'm like, holy shit, this is me like knocking everybody out. And literally on the next run, I'm like, you know what? I think I can make a video where I showed how I trained and worked up to that. You saw some of it, but not much, bits and pieces. So I created it. I actually typed up a letter, you know, to my current customers. And I'm like, hey, guys, you know, here's a video of me actually, you know, how to knock out any attacker within seconds. It's cool. It's got fight footage and stuff like that. I think I sold, like, back then I was competing with, I don't know if you remember, Panther.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Productions.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, like $59.95.
Yeah.
So I sold like 200 copies. I don't know what that works out to, but that's how I paid for my wedding oh, wow. receptions. Yeah, that's was so cool. with that video. And then I realized, shit, it's not going to be one video or one book. I started then creating categories, as you know, like stretching and then leg kicks and then my iron defense. And then with the grappling, which we can get into, it was a whole nother, you know, at some point people didn't even know I had striking art was my foundation art. Cause you know, yeah. I started putting out these videos, and again, just in the same pattern of, like systematically trying to, you know, put the techniques, how I would teach them, drilling them and so forth, and then putting them on the video. I did that all for myself and in my classes, but I figured if I'm going to survive, I got to figure out how to monetize that, mm-hmm. you know, because I had a dad that was just like, he hated the whole concept. I mean, before I even got into martial arts, baseball was my thing.
Right.
And I think I was going to be a professional baseball player. There was absolutely no way I wasn't going to be a baseball player. I started when I was like, I think 7 or 8, played mm-hmm. baseball. And I just got intimidated when I got into the bigger leagues. And that's probably part of the reason why I looked into weight training and martial arts, and it just got sidetracked. But baseball was my thing.
And on that note, though, when you did get sidetracked, I know you started in Kempo. What system of Kempo did you do?
I think it was called American Kempo Karate. Yeah, so the guy still has his school.
That was my foundation. Did you do Ed Parker style or Tracy's or?
I'd have to go back and find out exactly what the lineage is, but he's right here. He's in Yonkers. The guy, yeah. I think it's 50 years. It's the same. I mean, if that isn't a wow. testament, he was the nicest guy. Did it part-time. That wasn't his full-time thing, but he had a student just bought, I think, the school a couple of years ago, but what I found interesting about that was the curriculum was like flipped.
I remember.
It was privates.
That's right. I did the same thing. Yeah. You did private. And then during the week, you
learned all the moves.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
you had some group classes where yeah. you did pad work. And I think that's lost a little bit in a lot of the traditional karate schools, because when you think about martial arts, like you think of, like, I got into karate because I wanted to learn how to defend myself. Right. Like
yeah.
getting choked over a hood of a car, somebody puts you in a headlocks or whatever. But then when you start doing the katas and tournaments, you kind of get sad and you're like, oh, I'm going to my kicks. And you know, it's like, wait a minute, you know, what about self-defense and everything like that? So that's why I always envision, like, you know, if, like Kyokushin, the way we did Sanchin basics, like, you know, there were the 10 or 20 hand techniques, the 10 or 20 kicking techniques. You did it in the Sanchin stance. You did. I said, if we just weaned that down a little and then added drilling with, like, takedown, headlock, or whatever. So conceptually, I was like, you could be the most badass fighter because you have the foundational training methods of like a Kyokushinkai traditional dojo, but with a little bit more, not, I wouldn't even say open-mindedness, just, you know, added curriculum. you know, if that makes any sense.
It makes perfect sense, and it is a lot I want to talk to you about. At some point, though, you transitioned from Kenpo to Kyokushin. Did you get a black belt in Kenpo or at that point?
No, and I was there for like maybe 2 or 3 months while I was in the eighth grade.
So how did you end up in Kyokushin?
Well, as I mentioned before, what I did was I just loved the idea of the martial arts, but in a strange way, I was almost embarrassed to go back because I quit, if that makes any sense. I don't know. You know, it's strange. Maybe I wanted to try something a little different. So I took a bus out as furthest as I can go, and it just happened to be a Kyokushin karate school. I mean, the way fate sometimes happens, you know, I just happened to stumble on, you know, an affiliate of Masoyama, you know, one of Masoyama's affiliate schools, right? His biggest disciple, you know, Shigeru Oyama. You know, with another crazy Japanese guy that was teaching, that lived in the dojo, you know, I was like, holy cow. And I got within 6 months, I think I skipped like 2 or 3 belts when I did the first promotion test, Soshu Oyama. At that time, he was called Saiko Shihan Oyama.
Yes,
and I got promoted a couple of belts after the first test. So Sensei Yoki said, listen, I want to work out a deal with you. If you help me teach the kids classes, because nobody liked to teach the kids classes because they didn't have, it wasn't the philosophy now where now it's all psychological, you know, like they're 45 minute classes. You do a lot of fun drills. No, their classes were exactly the same as the adults. They were like two, 3 hours. You did the same. These kids were like after 15 minutes, you know, he used to hang them by the belt, the obi. There were beams going across. I would come to the class and they would be like 10 kids hanging off because they were all misbehaving in the class. I think they did it on purpose because they all wanted to hang off.
Can you imagine you did that today?
Yeah. Oh my God. And that wasn't even bad. I mean, I used to have, you know, the shinai.
Yeah.
I would have one parent that would come up to me and goes, you see that stick you got there? Can you hit my kid a little bit harder? You know, so you can, you know, and then another one would be like, I can't believe you do that. You know, you hit kids with that wooden bamboo staff. I mean, but so what happened was he goes, look, I did so well because I tried to model his training teaching methods. In return for teaching the kids, I got free lessons. So I went every day. I would teach the kids after school, you know, 3:30, 4 o'clock for like 2 hours. And then I would do the 3 1-hour classes almost every night. And then and then on the weekends, then I used to try different challenges. Like the school was about 8.5 miles from my home. So I tried a couple of times to run to the dojo, then took the 3 hour class. I never made it back though. I mean, and even in the class, I'd be doing push-ups and like blood's coming out of my nose. I'm like, you know, something doesn't feel right here, but just ran like 8.5 miles. We're doing like 3-4 hours of karate training after that. But, it was an interesting time. So the Kyokushin was purely just one of these happy little accidents, you know, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up training at the Kyokushin Kai Dojo.
As you're saying that, I can't find it here, but you would know. Is that the same dojo that
Ninomiya,
Willie Williams and William Oliver and those
No,
guys?
They were in, that was in Connecticut. But in the Scarsdale Dojo where I trained in, there's clips of Ninomiya.
Right.
Doing bad work in that dojo. That dojo was like an incubator for a lot of the Japanese guys at the time. In Connecticut, I think that was like one of the main headquarters for Saiko Shihan Oyama's dojo.
I see.
Then they had it was called the Scarsdale Dojo. It was actually his partner was an American guy that owned that. Now, when I got my black belt and Hiyoki left for Arizona, like not many people know it. I mean, this guy, Sensei Hiyoki, he's like just like obscurely teaching in Arizona somewhere. I don't even think he has patches on his gi. I mean,
he doesn't. He wears nothing.
I mean, it's just when I think about him, he completely influenced my whole life going forward. And just, you know, as a second father figure.
How so? Just his teaching style, presence? What was it? What was it about him?
His dedication.
Right.
His dedication to the art. You know, we would just talk about everything. I mean, at one point it was really, the discussions were about, you know, like life and business and money. He's like, Marco, look, as long as if you're passionate about something and you pursue it, those things will take care of itself. And that always stuck to my mind. But, you know, but when you hear you know, like when I was listening to the guys like with, about like Pettis and Reed and everything like that, it's that part of the art, like, you know, the way everything's split off and every, I mean, a lot of it is politics and money and everything. It's, I mean, to have a dojo, like when I taught a few times at the headquarters when it moved to Manhattan, it would be like 200-300 students there. You walk in there, it's like everybody's just like, oh,
yeah, so I've seen like, holy shit, that. Wow,
that's insane.
Yeah,
I did a couple of stints when Yama went to Japan. He's like, hey, why don't you stay in the dojo for like a week or so? So I was always the round eye, you know, with all the Uchi. I was always compared to the Uchi Dashi. They always put me in there to get my ass kicked by these guys. So it was an amazing experience. But I remember when we did the videos, the Perfect Karate videos, like that's when I started thinking because they did a whole promotion on that. And I remember, you know, the articles in the Japanese karate magazines. Yep. So I don't want to get too graphic, but I'm literally in the bathroom stall, right? In the headquarters, like getting up, cleaning myself up. And I look down and there's like a page flipped open on the floor of one of the karate magazines. I guess the Uchi Deshi just left it in there. And it's like a 2-page spread of me doing that split kick.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm saying,
iconic kick.
I think people know me, you know, maybe at this point in Japan. I'm like, and you know, you start thinking like, wow, you know, how much effort. And then, you know, the schism was a little bit after I won in 87, I did try to come back in, I think it was like 91 or 92. I was already out of college. I was like on 2 or 3 different careers. I was trying to figure myself out.
Right.
I decided to go back. I trained a little bit. I lost over 20 pounds within like a month. And here's where it got really crazy. I lost weight to get into the lightweight division. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So because I was kind of out of the scene for a while, I was like the perfect weapon. So there was an odd number in the lightweights. So they picked me and threw me into the middleweight division after I lost all the weight. And there was a Dutch team there, you know, these guys from Holland or whatever, these guys.
Monsters.
When a whole team comes with their own fight doctor and there's like 30 guys with the exact same gis and everything, you know, these guys fucking mean business, man. So my first fight is in the middleweight division after I tried to lose 20 pounds within like a couple, you know, like 4 to 6 weeks to get into the lightweight division. I think I went into 2 overtime rounds with this guy. I got punched in the throat. I was getting punched in the face. My rib broke. And was, you know, after that, he's like, Marco, I can't believe it. So little time, you wait. He goes, you're going to Japan to fight. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. He's like, so I had to come up with, I had to figure out how to get there, mm-hmm. where to stay, mm-hmm. you know, who's going to be my, I mean, just like basic, I'm like, you know, I'm trying to look for a job. And here I may end up having to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to go somewhere, possibly, you know, I don't know if I'm going to come back alive or not. You know what I mean? You know, like, I think it's time to kind of figure out, you know, a different little situation for myself. You know what I mean? So, but you can't listen. It happens at the highest levels in the biggest organizations. I mean, in the corporate world, it's the same thing. You know, for me. But you know, even when I started teaching, you know, because I had a small dojo, I had about 50 guys. You know, one of the reasons I opened up a school actually, because I was doing pretty well with the videos, was I couldn't get credit card processed. It was very hard to get for a mail order company because he didn't have a physical address. So I opened up a dojo, got an 800 number just so I can film my videos in the dojo and then sell the videos, right? With the 800 number and the credit card processing. So I never went more than like 50 or 60 guys, and they were all either brown or black belts. There was, I would say probably 25% were new guys that would come in, but they all knew me from my videos and stuff. So I was just training that. So I was like envisioning, you know, now you see like UFC center or whatever. I was like, I was already kind of envisioning, wow, it'd be cool to have a facility where it's like just top fighters from all over the world would come in and share their techniques and train, but with the traditional foundation, you know, that's how I ended up. I'm skipping over my judo, but that's how I ended up with Edson Carvalho in the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu because of his judo background. When I moved from New York to New Jersey and I was looking at BJJ schools, I walked into this school and I heard us, they were wearing gis, they were kneeling. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in heaven.
Yeah, you're home.
You know what I mean? So,
let's talk about that transition. So you went from Kyokushin. So what was the first step? Was it Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? Judo.
Judo, yeah. I trained with Oishi Sensei. What I did was I had my dojo, and I was living the dream at the time because I was making money with the videos, the VHS tapes, and then the DVDs. I transitioned into that. That was me becoming modern.
Yeah.
And I started doing privates with Oishi. The first class was amazing because this guy at the time was, you know, he's got to be in his 70s now. So he's probably in his 50s. I took privates with him. Mm-hmm. First, because what I did is I took privates there and then I taught in my own dojo. So I was almost kind of using my dojo as an incubator or my students as guinea pigs to accelerate my judo training. Like everything, I would have notebooks. Every class, I made sure I learned at least one new thing, but it ended up being like, 10 pages of notes on, you know, how to do a rollout, how to do a cross lapel choke, whatever. And ironically, at that time, Henzo Gracie started his New York City school there with this guy, Craig Kukuk. Mm-hmm, I don't know if you know who Craig Kukuk is, but they used that dojo. So I used to take all the judo classes and then sit there and watch Craig's class. And
oh, wow. That's awesome.
Until after a few months, he goes, listen, you got to either join or get the hell out of here. I was like, well, this is how Helio did it. No, he watched his brothers. And then one day, I'm just learning. But Oishi Sensei, so for about a year, I did privates. The very first class, he goes, all right, knees down. So he goes, come at me. And I'm like, I'm gonna kill this guy, man. Yeah. As soon as I put my hand on his lapel, I woke up in another part of the dojo. and believe me.
Oh, no, you froze up a bit.
A lot of times. I was like, ew. He goes, I'm Pelito Tanya. I'm like, shit, I got to know this. I got to know everything about this. And I just went on a mission. I would go down to the class with, with the judo and jujitsu books like piled up on my passenger seat, in my car. And then they're just coming back and taking notes. Wow. And then after about a year, he's like, listen, you just know me. You got to come to the class and train with different heights, weights, levels of skill and so forth. And I memorized every tile. I put that on my video. And every tile in the dojo from being his, he had this ingenious teaching method. This is what he did. I would go to class. The private was about an hour, but he would hold me in a pin for like 40, 45 minutes and then show me the escape. I'm like, this guy is ripping me off. He was lighter than me, smaller than me, and it felt like a Mack truck was sitting on my chest. All those pinning techniques. So when he said come to class, I was able to get my brown belt. I think within like 18 months in judo, and then I started entering tournaments. Now I left karate because it was very political. I couldn't believe how political judo was. Like I was going into tournaments as a brown belt, and my goal was always to win a championship day. I've never got that far because I learned very quickly. Like every time I won, you were supposed to accrue points to get your black belt. Mm-hmm. But even within tournaments, if you weren't in the right organization, those points didn't apply. And I'm like, shit, I'm going to have to, it's going to take me years and years and years just to, accrue the right points with the right organization. And I'm like, this is even worse. And that was like wrestling. Like these guys, they were a lot younger than me. I mean, they would go and do three tournaments on a weekend. I'm like, I don't have the time for that. I think I was in my mid to upper 20s at the time. It was like, I'd have to stop everything, and start competing every weekend and travel around the country. So I just, stayed there for as long as I can and taught at my karate school. I ended up, I closed my school. It was a very emotional moment, but it was an epiphany. I was going to negotiate my lease with the landlord. Mm-hmm. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm like, you know what? Whether I have one student or 100 students, this guy wants his rent every month. He doesn't give a shit what I got going on here. Right. I think I want to be that guy one day. So, because my father used to always plant a seed in my mind.
I was going to ask you how you got into real estate. Okay.
You got to do real estate. You got to do, my dad was pushing me, but you never do what your parents tell you to do, right? You have to be defiant. And I don't know if you know about the Albanian community, like they own like about a third of the rental stock in the Bronx. There are guys that don't even have high school educations that own, $50, $100, $200 million worth of, multifamily real estate in the Bronx. some of these guys, my father helped, you know, like that he'll like in back, imagine in 1970s lending somebody like 10 grand and he buys a 50, 60 unit apartment building, you know, that thing's worth $10 million, yeah, you know, today. Right. So he, even though he never did it, we had a little 6-unit in the Bronx that he sold and we bought a house in Westchester. That was his foray into real estate. But he was always like, Marco, you should explore real estate. I'm like, Dad, you don't understand. It's very hard. And, you know, we don't have the money to buy a building. Little did I know, a lot of these guys started as an agent. So I literally shut my school down, got my real estate license, dove into that. And, you know, I applied the same principles of martial arts. That's why, like I said, when people say martial arts can change your life, it can. I think I sold like about $2 billion worth of real estate over the last 20 years, you know, and these are all smaller deals, sort of volumes, insane. Right. And I have some nice closings coming up now, hopefully soon, but you know, the COVID thing with, you know, that's a whole different discussion, yeah, but the commercial real estate, I became fascinated with, and now it's like I'm coming full circle. Like I can just envision maybe owning my own properties and having you know, having my own dojo, mm-hmm, in the true way that I think it should be. Mm-hmm. And if I make money there, wonderful. If not, I have these other avenues, you know, that that I'm exploring. But you know, it's a tough business. You got to get into every fad. You know, kids. I mean, at one point I've seen, you know, like, how do you teach a 3-year-old, you know, 4-year-old karate? Yeah. You gotta have like a babe. You gotta have like a diaper changing station somewhere or something. It's like, I don't know. It's tough. It's a tough business, you know?
And you've always had this entrepreneurial spirit, obviously. I mean, like you started out doing these videos and books right now that it's, I mean, flash forward into real estate. I mean, it still has that same theme of like working for yourself.
I guess, you know, I don't know. You know, maybe it's part of, you know, the mentality, you know, that my dad, having been, you know, in a communist country and escaping, you know, with his three brothers, one was killed or whatever. It's like,
wow. During the escape, idea, you mean?
What's that?
He was killed during the escape?
Yeah, during the escape. Oh, they had to, like, imagine, you know, like bury him in the mountains and then hope you don't get caught and then end up throughout Europe. That's how we met my mom in Italy.
Right.
France, Germany, and what have you. So the idea of being like self-sufficient and not somebody telling you what to do. I mean, I've been in the corporate world. Listen, my success has been in large corporate real estate firms.
Right.
But the real estate itself, you're always in your own business, even if you're right, working for a large company.
Sure, you're in sales. Your portfolio. Yeah.
So you live and die. We have a saying: you eat what you kill. Right. In commercial real estate, not the most, you know, not the most thrilling career opportunity, you know, like imagine. And I started when I was 29. It's not like, it's very hard to convince a kid coming out of college, like, listen, you're not gonna make no money for like 2 or 3 years, probably go into debt. You're going to get your ass kicked on the phones every day. People are going to call you an asshole. They're not going to trust you, whatever. I'm like, yeah, that's for me, man. That's I'm ready to go.
Sign me up.
I'm like, sign me up, you know. But listen, you know, the cold calling. I'm doing stuff now, like on LinkedIn and whatever, you know, like I've trained sales agents and stuff. You know, I always thought maybe I could do something like that. And I'm like, wait a minute, man. I have to sleep sometimes.
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I mean? Create a whole course and training development and everything like that. So, Jesus. but I'm totally obsessed now. Like I said, like just today, I did 3 hours this morning, you know, but, and it's like, I'm not fighting anybody in a couple of weeks. So I've been building up my training and seeing where, you know, where I need to focus on things. And
well, I've even been watching you just over this past year or so during the pandemic, like just on the social, yes, media stuff, and you transformed yourself.
Little by little.
Yeah.
Bicycling. I'm completely obsessed with bicycling.
But what inspired you to get right back into all this stuff?
Back in January of last year, you might've had friends that may have had a bout of something like between November and let's say February of 2020, when it wasn't really a big thing yet, right? Whatever happened, it was about 5 weeks. I was really sick. I was coughing my brains out. My body was completely sore, achy. I was in bed for 2 days. I've never been bedridden for 2 days. I couldn't get out of bed. My wife was pulled out the old nebulizer from when my kids were, you know, babies. And you know, I'm like breathing this shit. I'm trying to create steam like over a, you know, hot pot So I called my doctor and he's like, yeah, go. I had a physical in March. So this was in January. He's like, listen, I'm going to see you in a couple of months. Just go see one of my colleagues. Guys like down my throat with a thumb to pester, you know, tongue to, nobody knew anything at the time. No mask.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, looks like you have a cough. Here's a prescription for some cough medicine. I was like guzzling that shit at like 3 weeks in. Like, this is not doing anything.
Yeah.
And then, but then around that time, right, the end of November, you know, what was it? The CDC. I mean, even as late as January 21st, they said there was no human to human transmission. I mean, these fucking people don't know what's, I don't think anybody knows what's going on, you know? So I'm reading the symptoms. I'm like, holy shit, I'm going to die. Honey, I'm dying. I'm going to die. I got to do something. So by the time
March, sorry to laugh, but it's
I said, you know, because I was heavy and I'm thinking, oh, you get, if you're overweight and this and that.
Yeah.
So,
so now you're convinced you have the Rona.
Yeah, I had it, or what I thought I had it, or whatever. Yeah. But so by the time my physical came in March, he's like, oh no, everything looks fine. I'm like, can I test for antibodies? Like, well, we don't really do that. You know, there's some hospitals that were taking volunteers. Like, I was going on websites to see. I mean, there was no way to do it. It wasn't a formalized thing at the time.
Yeah.
So I just bit the bullet. And then on March 13th, Friday the 13th in March, you know, the doctor, it's like, Marco, look, I know you were into like fitness and everything, but you know, just keep an eye on your weight. That's all I needed to hear. I'm like, keep an eye on my weight. The 14th, I got on my bike. I went around the block one time. I talk about this in my the free videos that I put online about my training.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a deck in my backyard. I went up it once and then down it once. And I did that 10 times. And then I would try to do it 12, then 20. Then I would walk up and run down, you know, because I figured with my weight, it, you know, it's easier to run down than it is run up. So I just, and then I put more and more on my bike. And before I knew it, like within three and a half months, I lost 37 pounds.
Wow.
In June, I did my first 100-mile bike ride. It took 8 hours and 30 minutes. I didn't go for speed or anything. It's just
endurance.
I became obsessed with bicycling because, you know, people chuckle, but you think a bike ride, I'm going up for a little bike ride, you know, like a little girl with the things, the flip things on there. But these guys take it seriously.
Yeah.
And it doesn't hurt. Like, it doesn't have the impact of running or whatever. So I'm thinking to myself, this is like one of the most amazing exercises in life. So I thought I was a badass when I hit the 7-10, you know, mile. Then I started doing the bike trail that I take is about 18 miles. So I know for a fact I'm doing at least 18 to 20 miles. I did that. I did a post. I think it was over a 180-day period. I did 163 rides. I did like 2,800 miles. That's the equivalent of like riding across the United States of America, you know? And I'm like, so that's been like the core of my training. Is I know that if I get the bike ride in first, it's an extended warm up. And then I just pick, you know, 8 or 10 different stations, you know, I'll do like a rounds of bag work, makiwara, I'll do some floor drills, like, you know, bridging and rollouts and things of that nature. So all of that is in preparation for hopefully, you know, one day when we do get back on the mats a little bit more formally after this whole thing is over. But now I feel like I'm training for that. It's not going to balance myself. You know, look, you know, based on all these posts and everything now, I'm doing a seminar for a very, very high level Taekwondo school in Pennsylvania.
Cool.
Phil Amaris, he'll show disciple. Pretty cool. I mean, he has.
Oh, really?
Utmost,
is he? Okay. Oh, okay.
Utmost respect for the Oyama organization, has met Oyama, you know, incorporate a lot of that training into his dojo. So we're going to do something there. I'm going to fly down. I got another guy in Florida. So those have actually now becoming my, you know, instead of I'm going to be competing in the world tournament 6 months from now, like I'm going to do a seminar. So I'm like focusing on the curriculum and getting into shape, you know.
That's
and
fantastic, it, man. That's yeah, it makes,
it's pretty cool.
I know a lot of people are excited about it, and including even like people I know that knew you were coming on this weekend.
Oh, wow.
Like,
awesome. I still can't even believe that half the time.
Oh, like, that's all I hear is, wow, he's a legend. He's a legend. And so even my buddy, Shion Terry Burkus, so we have this other show called Real Talk, and even him and I have been talking.
Yeah, I think
we've
interacted a few times, online.
Yeah, he's great. He's a hilarious guy. But, and him and I were chatting even just like yesterday and stuff, and I know some things he even wanted me to talk to you about Because you have incorporated, like you went from Kyokushin, you went into the grappling and all the stuff and started incorporating all, and we'll get into like you creating your own system and stuff. Did you find, like, I have so many questions even around that. Like,
I'm sorry. I'll let you just shoot out the questions and I'll
no, because I never look at this like interviews. These are
Okay.
conversations. So it's just like us having a beer.
No problem.
But these are my own that just, but the grappling and stuff that you were doing, did you find anything? I'm all over the place with this, but I mean, you've done all this kata, you've done all this stuff in Kyokushin, and I'm assuming when you learned kata in Kyokushin, they weren't breaking it down into bunkai and application.
No.
You were just learning it. Now,
Yeah, I mean, if we did it down block, we interpret that as that's a down block. If somebody throws something at that level, it wasn't like very intricate or anything like that. But,
Right. And it's funny you should say that because Terry and I have talked about that one. Like coming out of Okinawan systems, they don't even consider that a down block. That's a
a
throw.
strike,
That's a
right?
throw. A
Or
throw.
throw, or
And
throw. Okay.
tripping somebody over your leg. I can't do it
It
here on
makes
camera.
sense.
And
It makes sense.
over your leg, right? So you're just knocking
Right.
them over. Anyway, I'm just wondering, like, had you made any other connections like that when you got into grappling? Did you find like was there any use? Did you get any use out of the kata that you were doing from
I
Kyokushin?
don't, you know, I think it was just more of, I don't know if there was a direct correlation of it and just mechanically somebody teaches you a move and you know how to do it. So now, and this is where I have a problem with it. Like if you go to like my son did wrestling in high school, like if I tried to show him how to do a takedown or a throw based on my kata and use it on the mat, he would do even worse than he did, you know, when, you know, when he started. You know, because you know, I was watching. There was, I'm not going to mention the name, but there was like there's a karate guy that's very famous online, and he did some move from you know where you do the back leaning stance with the block and this here, and he interpreted that as a front choke. And I'm like, dude, if you think that somebody's going to instinctually do a front choke, let's say somebody comes at you with a tackle, and you're going to go in and do a front choke and hook his leg because you did that for 5 years, it's not. I just can't. You got to do it. You know, I think I explained in my Tetsubushi Jitsu what this. I started seeing this when I was doing tournaments outside of the Oyama style. You know, the point before I was doing full contact. So I would go to these tournaments, like at you know, at the Felt Forum, at the Garden, or some high school, and you had every art imaginable there. You know, Wing Chun. You know, Shotokan, Taekwondo, whatever, beautiful weapons, kata, and everything. When it came to the point fighting, it looked like bad boxing. And you know, up to like 2/10 of a second, the guy did his art, and then it was just a brawl. And then you're like, oh man, that was the worst fucking jab I've ever seen. Or it looked like he tried to, it looked like that guy was trying to take him down, you know, but he got caught. And I'm like, all right, so why don't you do some jabs, cross hooks, and uppercuts? Because you know, look, I don't, you know, when I researched, like I heard one guy, it was a some, you know, something about like in karate, there's no answer to a boxing jab. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, you can tai sabaki, you can get out of the way or whatever, but who jabs once? Like, how many times can you do tai sabaki on an 8 or 9 punch combination, right? And then how are your blocks going to work there? That's why I saw like, you know, Oyama, like the parry started becoming more of the formal, you know, blocking and so forth and so on. It's, you know, I've always looked at it when you learned the alphabet. I don't know if you remember those notebooks that had the solid line and then the little dotted line in there, and then you had to go up and down. That's to me, that was what karate was. Then you learned, you know, words. You put words together, sentences, paragraphs, and then you learned graph, you know, how to write in script. And that was like some, you can't even read people's handwritings. But to me, that's what happens to your art. But you have to start with a foundation. But the bunkai, I've always researched it, but I was like, you know, I don't know. Look, there was a guy, I forget which UFC it was, and I don't think he was a high-ranking knockdown fighter, but he did an embarrassing performance in one of the early UFCs. I'm like, you know, that dude, you know, well, how come he didn't just like say he can like right into the guy's chest and pop his sternum or something like that? And like you start thinking, like, you know, I get to get a little backup in my training, you know. But with me, it was like an obsession. Like, based on the Kyokushinkai philosophy, you can't lose, right? You know, that mentality, give up or whatever. Okay, so if I'm doing judo, I got to have that mentality in judo. And then I started trying to figure out, like, can I make my striking more effective if I can at least hang at a higher level with my grappling? Because let's say I can engage somebody as if I'm grappling and go right into an elbow or a leg kick or something like that. Like, the guy's going to be like, no, I'm going to strike, you know? So then you start thinking, can I go after his weakness or whatever? But, you know, but I have the high, you know, my aspiration is there should be a Kyokushinkai like style. I think Blumming tried to explore that, you know, John Blumming with the British. I mean, that guy was a psycho. I've watched some of his videos. Yeah. And then you offshoot, and I see, like, there's this other guy that he did some seminars with that was just fascinating, the way he combined, the parries of, like, Enshin, and then going into, like, a fireman's carry and then a leg lock. I'm like, you know, that's what gets me goosebumps.
Are you familiar with Kudo?
Well, of course. Are you kidding me? He just passed away. I think he was involved with Blumming. There was an affiliation there. So, like, to me, I think that was on the right track with the judo and the striking and what have you. You know, the one thing I have to say, that, you know, it's funny, you know, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu and judo, like, I chuckled because there was a schism. Now all these guys know that if you're in BJJ, you got to have a black belt in judo and vice versa. You know, my instructor used to say it was the two wheels of a bicycle. Right?
Interesting.
So, and then somebody else was telling me then, you know, the striking is like the frame and the chain, and then you have the two wheels, which is just, it's like,
cool analogy.
We can go crazy on that. Right. And the throttle is your endurance, you know, all that. Yeah, so, the kudo, I like what they did, obviously, with the headgear, you know, and that goes back. And I think I've seen some reference you had in the past with Nonomiya with the human face of karate when the challenge with Thailand.
Yeah.
But again, you know, if you're a real student of the art and you're training, and then you have these disciples that go to Thailand, but they had to learn the system to a degree to defeat the system, in a sense, right? They seek out a boxing guy or, you know, somebody that knew head punching and understanding Thai.
All of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, I think that's the one benefit of what happened with the internet and YouTube. Like, you know, I feel like I missed out about 10 to 15 years of social media because I was that guy, right? In black belt, I had the videos and everything.
Yeah.
And then I just, you know, I did ultimately have a little website. I converted from VHS to DVDs, but then I kind of disappeared. That's when I should have been building up my 2-4 million followers, but now I'm jumping back in. But the one thing, you know, there was always an argument that you can't learn through video. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can. And I forget it was a documentary that I watched. It was like the Discovery Channel or something. There were these doctors that volunteered their service. They went to, like, Africa somewhere, and they were doing surgeries, and there was something that they didn't quite understand. And I think some doctor faxed them, you know, from the States, like, diagrams, like, how to do a surgery or something. Like, holy shit. I mean, this is not like sparring or fighting. This is like saving somebody's life. They weren't familiar with the procedure. They got faxed instructions on how to do something. I'm like, that's what we should be doing as martial artists, strong foundation, understand combat or whatever. But then if I see an arm lock explained to me from a legit master, I should immediately know how to integrate into my art, either to defend against it or to apply it. It sounds crazy, but
no, you know, not at all.
That's to me is what I think Musashi was striving for, you know what I mean? In terms of his quest, you know, to be undefeated, so to speak. I mean, that doesn't happen. My judo instructor, you always say, if somebody's undefeated, they just didn't meet the right guy, you know? In his dojo, you know, it was like, if you won 51% of the time, you were pretty good. You were pretty goddamn good. You know what I mean? If you won 6 out of 10 times in your training. You hear these guys undefeated, 1,000 fights, you know, there were some judo guys that the whole thing with, when you read about, like, the invasions, like in Europe, of the judokas, that came and they, you know, some of them got beat, but, you know, the stomach throw, you know, with Tomonaga, is the stomach throw, like, that was a secret back then. You know, I was like, but once the big wrestler figured that shit out, you know, it's all right. Now it's like, you got to reinvent the, you know, I got to figure out another way to get this, to get this guy. And that's how fighting evolves in my humble opinion. You know what I mean? So that's my A-ish philosophy.
but I've seen videos though of you when back in the day when you were doing, I'm trying to remember, there was one video I saw you guys were training outside. I think it might have been a summer camp or something, a Kyokushin. Kyokushin.
Yes, yeah.
But the way, so you guys are sparring, but there's trapping, there's takedown sweeps and stuff.
Yeah,
like they were doing a lot of that back.
I was trying to keep up with Soshu Oyama's son.
So they were training that way.
Well, in the fight classes, yes. You know, there was like a fight team where that's where I think maybe the Thai influence came in, or a little bit of the, you know, like the sparring was different than the static punching, or right. when you do the one step, the self defense, right?
Yeah.
So the next level was the pad work or whatever. So you know, trying to catch kicks and things of that nature, it was an evolution. But you're right. I mean, even back now that I think of it, I mean, sticking right in my mind that sweep that Ted Oyama did was poetic. Mm-hmm. So you know, all the stuff that you couldn't really do in knockdown, I guess, right? Listen, I heard stories about Soshu Oyama. I mean, this guy, I think he did some bouncing, and from what there was a story I heard where like he would set the tables up in a certain way so that if there was some shit going on the other end of the room, he'd be able to jump on every table and be there within seconds. And you know what the techniques were? Groin kicks. Groin kicks worked all the time. But I can just see, like, you know, everybody's just like having a drink and everything like that. And just this crazy Japanese guy flying across 15 tables to get to you know, a problem on the other side of the bar.
Talk about another legend. Wow. Yeah.
Oishi in the judo, and then ultimately, you know, Edson Carvalho kind of blended it together, you know, because he started actually judo when he was like four, but then he was training with the Carlson Gracie guys. You know, there's some stuff online. It's funny, him and Waleed Ismael, you know, the guy that choked out boys like him. There was some bad blood with them. They got kicked out of a top judo guy in Brazil's dojo because they were fucking beating the shit out of each other. There was like some bad blood there. So, you know, it's all that internet lore, but definitely, you know, the Carlson Gracie, lineage, they were more like, you know, there's this whole thing inside, you know, about the Gracie jiu-jitsu from the pure, you know, it's self-defense techniques
versus,
you know,
the sports side.
Yeah. The sports side with Carlson Gracie or whatever. Yeah. And again, to me, like I would have been the guy, I'm like, what are you guys doing, man? You got to do both. Listen, there's an interesting, there was a video there, this guy that I tagged along, Tony Penske, online, brilliant. He's in Japan right now, learning judo. He's high ranking Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy. He even told me his quest is to go check out the Kyokushin. That was his next goal. But, you know, but we would always talk about, you know, the integrating that. But there was a little video where he was in a jiu-jitsu school doing a seminar. And he took out, I think it was a blue belt to get a blue belt takes a long time. And he put the guy in a headlock and the guy didn't know like how to get out of it. Ooh. I mean, that's like class number one, you know, you understand? So but I think if you went to 95% of karate schools and you put somebody in a real headlock or a scarf hold, they'd be clueless. They would think they can punch their way out of it. It's not going to happen. You know, you always heard that, like Oyama, Soshu Oyama or Masu Oyama, like, oh, he was like a third degree in judo and he had a kendo black belt, whatever. It's like, why not me? You know what I mean? Let me explore that too.
Sure.
You know,
good point.
Or do something crazy, like try to create the Tetsubushi Jitsu system and integrate all the only. So I need about 2.5 lifetimes to get to that.
Yeah,
to
no
that
kidding.
Goal.
So what inspired you? What inspired you to do that at that time? Like, is it just because you just, it wasn't available and you just wanted to pull all that stuff together?
Yeah. I mean, I just, I don't know. I just looked at it as reality fighting, you know, there's a couple of other guys there. That was a big thing for a while too. Reality based, you know, where you created these drills and you're walking around the corner. I think, Tony Blauer. He's pretty cool. We actually did a seminar. We ended up doing a seminar together. It was like one of Jerry Beasley's karate college. So that my brother-in-law, who's has nothing to do with martial arts, he was with me there. We went to this thing. My wife was there. You know, my daughter was like this. Maurice Smith was there. Who's the wrestler? Oh my God! My tongue. The guy that hoist Howard, the big he's got the mustache.
Dan Severn.
But you had all these guys there. Dan Severn. I did the drill with Dan. You know, the one where you like you're like a monkey and you go around the arms and stuff like that. Like I did that at the seminar with him as a demo. And you know, Smith, you know, Superfoot, all those guys. I'm like, I'm there. And I'm like, holy shit. These are all the guys I see in the magazines. And I'm at, you know, Beasley's College doing a work, doing one of the sessions there, one of the workshops. But Blau was cool because when he had the panic, you know, with the Panther Productions and stuff like that. Yeah. So I was like, man, that's what it's all about. Like, I have to admit, it's like, because of the mentality of the Kyokushinkai training, it's like, you know what? I could do it better because I'm a Kyokushin guy, right? That was always my feeling with, whether it be with judo or jujitsu or whatever, if there's anything that Kyokushinkai and that spirit of never giving up, that's what this is. I did this purposely. That's the one and only time. Yeah. That's the one and only. I don't have any. I don't get that crazy. My daughter actually has more tattoos than I do. But the idea of never giving up, to push yourself, right? Endure pain, you know, because there's that aspect of it. That mentality can be applied in any art, in any field of study.
Yeah.
And there should be nothing that can stop you, you know? And a lot of things, you know, happened the last couple of years. I lost my sister. She was 50. You know, my dad 10 years ago. I lost two training partners and my sister within a 6-month period in 2018. Just completely gave me a different perspective of life. You know, it's like, you got to go for it. You got to go for it. Because we're not going to be here for a very long time. You know what I'm saying?
And absolutely.
It's, but, you know, the thing with business and politics and, you know, it's an effect. I remember, I forget, it was an interview that I read, you know, where they asked Masayama, right? Because godlike, can kill bulls or what have you. They're like, what are you scared of? What are you scared of? Do you know what that answer was? Mm. Poverty. Like, you got to be kidding me, man. It's like, all right, I get it now. You know, it's like poverty's his biggest fear. I'm like, guy's got like 12 million members in the Kyokushinkai organization, whatever. It's like, this guy lives every day, you know, to the moment, you know, it's an amazing, amazing philosophy. That's why I said, you know, I'm going to pursue it. Why not? Be good at judo, good at Brazilian jiu-jitsu, because I know how to train and get to the level that I need to be, you know, just that is not enough time. You know, now I see MMA, I think, has basically almost become its own art.
That's what I was just going to ask you about, you know, that. Yeah. What your thoughts?
I don't know. It's the sporting aspect of it. I mean, look, you got kids now. I see like 8, 10, 12-year-old kids, man, you know, doing, you know, leg kicks, knees, elbows, then going into throws and then flowing into pins and then going into locks. I'm like, that's insane, you know. Yeah. But the one thing I think you have to be careful is because we've all seen those proteges. Like I remember there was a kid that I taught when I was in the Scarsdale Dojo. He was getting into magazines. He was doing point system, whatever. His parent brought him to every class or whatever. I'm like, you know what? I don't think this kid's going to make it past 14 years old in the martial arts. He just got burnt out, you know? So, you know, like I see a lot of these things on YouTube with the little, you know, there's this girl I always see that's beating up trees and shit. Like that. Is she 40 yet? I don't know. I mean, by the time she's 18, I don't know. She's probably going to be, I don't know, just, you know, working at a nail salon or something like that. I don't know. I mean, you know, there was that kid that was like ripped, you know, shreds, you know, what happened to him? I mean, I'm like, holy shit.
Did you ever see the documentary on that? There's a documentary, the follow-up. But it actually, to your point, it did. It burnt him out and he left the whole thing. And
that's why I think you have to have the traditional martial arts approach.
Foundation.
Look, there's, if you look at, let's say you go into the military, you learn how to kill somebody, right? but they're not teaching you the mind stuff.
Right.
See, I always looked at like the martial arts is we're doing the same thing, but because of meditation and working on the spiritual side and how to deal with people, like the dojo is always a microcosm of life. There's a hierarchy. One guy's a badass. Another guy's an asshole. This and that. Yeah. So you learn how to do that. Hopefully you have an instructor, you know, that through life experiences can coach you not only in the physical sense, but in the spiritual sense. And then also how to apply those principles outside of the dojo. So I think, you know, like you hear things like PTSD and things like that. I think martial arts can help those situations, unless it's just like it's a chemical or physiological problem. But, you know, but that's why I think you have to go for inside your mind and your spirit. You have to, I always taught you have to, you got to do it from the outside. It's hard to do it from the inside out. You have to kind of torture your body. I use torture, but train your body to affect physiologically something, the mental aspect inside and the physical, if that makes any sense. Whether it be adrenaline or what have you, you know, breathing and stuff like that. Like even like meditate, like what do you do when you meditate? You know, one instructor told me, he goes, imagine a rough seas, right? Or a raging river, and you're trying to get to the point where it's just like a quiet pond that's like mirror-like. You know, when you start, I think he would just say that so we could distract ourselves from whatever else you were thinking of at the time. But that's always kind of like a go-to for me. You know, it's try to imagine, you know,
focal point, calm
river. That way, like if even a pebble drops in there, you see the waves that come, that should be how you react to things in life, as small or as big as it is. You can sense it. Yeah. If that makes any sense at all. I don't know, but
it does. No, it makes total sense. And on that note, like how would you define your martial philosophy?
Well, it's my martial philosophy is basically the acronym PRAD, PRAD. I remember I used to drill it into my kids' vernacular. So because when somebody would say, what does us mean?
Right.
Us, patience, respect, appreciation, and discipline. PRAD, PRAD. Nice. And I don't know if my son be 8 years old, like Pratt, you know what I mean? And like, you'll know what I'm talking about one day, you know? Right. So patience, respect, appreciation, and discipline. You know, there's that concept of, you know, 3 years on a rock, you know, like who the hell would sit 3 years on a rock? You can't accomplish anything. And I would look it up and I'm like, you know what? 3 years on a rock, you would create heat on your ass from sitting on that rock. You know, so you are actually accomplishing something from doing that. So, but you need a lot of friggin' patience to sit on a rock for 3 years, you know. But if you think about that conceptually, you know, in any endeavor that you have in life, it feels like that sometimes. You know, you
absolutely
sit on a rock doing nothing, you know what I mean? And then boom, something, you know, something happens.
Yeah.
So my martial arts philosophy is completely embedded, entrenched, a derivative of the philosophy and the spirit of us, which is patience, respect, appreciation, and discipline.
Love it.
You know, that's the thing that I would express my philosophy as.
Do you have any regrets in your martial career?
I wish I competed more, you know.
Yeah.
It sounds crazy, but I hated fighting. That's why I train so hard.
you know what? It's a common thing.
Pierre has a similar philosophy.
I was just going to say it.
Fighting sucks, man. That shit hurts. So I would train and train and train. And then even sometimes I don't like to lose either. Mm-hmm. You know, but when I did a little thing on my Tetsubushi Jitsu Inner Secrets video where I discussed like how my son got into wrestling, you know, and these guys, they, you know, a tournament's coming up, you know, and you're training for 2, 3, 4 matches. You know, these guys have 30, 40 matches. To me, I would have loved to got to the point where I can compete, win or lose, with that fanaticism, like that many.
Right.
I think that many competitions, though, I think also can backfire on you physically. Like, you know, having gone into judo and jiu-jitsu, and there was that period where I didn't train for a while, I think it actually saved my limbs to a degree. Because I know guys my age already got like two knees, the fucking shoulder, the elbow, this, that. Yeah, I'm like, you know, thank God for now. I mean, I could
Judd and Nick, both of them have hip replacements.
I mean, that's to me, that's I can't even. I'm like, God bless. I mean, I you know, how do you guys do it? I mean, but my only regret is I wish I competed a little bit more, and I did, and I pushed, you know, on a business level. I just stayed with what I was trying to accomplish in terms of, like, you know, the advertising and the social media and everything. But you know, I think I tasted blood when I got my first like 5 and 6 figure commission checks when I was selling investment property. So that helped. And that's going to help me now, because you know, imagine training so hard. Like, I've never seen so many broke people in the arts, and it's sad. It's true, I'm like, this is not what, I mean, I understand passion and dedicating your life, but it's so hard. I mean, I came close to losing it all a couple of times, you know, because of my dedication. It's the scariest feeling in the world, especially if you have wife and kids and a home and this. So, you know, but now, like I said, having the way I did my videos, the way I've made them encyclopedic, I almost feel like now I'm going to teach myself again, you know, even though I'm trying to stay on top of the new, you know, I made a reference in one of my videos, like in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I think there's a guard for every letter in the alphabet now, you know, like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So it's like, all right, you know, let me focus on the 5 this and whatever. You can get sidetracked like really crazy.
But I do like your philosophy of how you break things out like that. I love that.
Yeah, and in a sense, I think that's why Kyokushin became such a worldwide phenomenon, because it actually seemed to filter out a lot of stuff. And the testament is it's his disciples, like all over the world, like these guys that broke off and started their own organizations. But where did it come from?
But you know, dissipated here, like here. I mean, you're in Jersey. I'm in Toronto. We're not that far from each other. I'm very familiar. I worked in Manhattan for a while, so I know it there. But I noticed in North America that Kyokushin dissipated. Like, it was really popular back, like when you were doing it, and even earlier. Yes. And then it started fading out. And I've asked this to other people, like, why do you think was it just that you know, things like MMA coming on the scene and jiu-jitsu, or was it the training, like where you were referencing the way you were training earlier and how hard it was. You can't do that anymore. Now you'll have somebody reporting you for some nonsense.
Yes. Part of it. I mean, I've never seen,
we're in a soft culture in North America.
I've never seen, you know, we're going a little off tangent here, but our problem is our wealth.
Yep.
You know, we have so much wealth, it's become an opiate. Yeah. Like, if you could sit on a couch and you got 1,000 fucking cable channels, you can get on an app, get breakfast, lunch, and dinner delivered to you, and you could still be relatively a poor person.
Yeah.
You have the richest poor people in the world in the United States. You know, you got a refrigerator, you got running water.
Yeah. And they're still complaining.
You got Netflix.
And still complaining.
Can you imagine going to a dojo like 5 times a week and training 3 hours each time and breaking it? I mean, I've interviewed people coming, you know, guys coming out of like Ivy League type schools. They want to make $100,000 like coming out of school, like in the first 90 days.
Yeah.
You know, and then if they don't like it, they bounce around and go to the next job and next job. Like, this is, I don't know how to, you know, I don't know how we're going to save that generation. You know,
it worries me.
Things tend to work its way out. I mean, you know, when you compare stuff, like, I wasn't around, you know, I always tell people, I get COVID, you know, we had a civil war, 2 world wars, the Revolutionary War, you know, the Great Depression, you know, then we had, you know, Lehman.
Yeah.
Think people bounce back. It's what you do in those valleys, right?
Yeah,
when you have the peaks and valleys, and it can be scary sometimes, you know. Yeah. That was my biggest fear. I mean, am I going to have to like dumpster dive at some point, or you know, like I always used to tell my wife, I'm like, you know what, honey? My father used to tell me all the time, all I need is bread and milk, and one room, you know, and a bed. I'm like, this guy, what the hell did they do to him over there? You know what I mean? It's like, you know, when I got into the arts, he's like, wait a minute, you spend all that time doing karate, you could be. I mean, you could have 3 jobs. You could, how much money you could make, you know? That's how he was with baseball too. Like baseball, like when I got my first uniform, I don't know what those things are. You put, you know, I forget what they're called, like the socks.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. I'm going through my first practice. I don't have socks on. I just have that thing on. Right. The cleats. You know, my mom's like, they're all wearing socks. I'm like, shit, we got to go back home. Like they have no, I was like, what do you mean? So, like a hobby? What are you talking about? Now you're going to, so that almost kind of like forced me to justify all that training by the monetization, so to speak, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. No, I was just thinking that. Yeah, yeah.
You know, everything's going to be fine, you know? And then, it's wild, but getting back to now, it's like, I try to tell my kids, I mean, you know, an iPhone is $1,000, you know, and you got, you have people that can't pay the rent and they have an iPhone. You know, it's, it's hard to connect, you know, but, God bless America. That's, you know, our wealth, I think our wealth has become a little bit of an opiate because if you have all that, then you might think, oh, if somebody had a little less, they would still be good. And, you know, I think there's an altruistic feeling there. I know I'm kind of getting off tangent here, but
no, this is great.
It's a socialist idea, nope. But, there's a little bit of self-sufficiency has gone out the window. And you see that everywhere. Like if I come out of an Ivy League school, does a corporation owe me a six-figure salary or do I have to work?
Right.
You know, I made $12,000 a year. I worked for a publishing company when I got out of college. Then I went to another firm. I jumped up to $23,000 a year. Yeah. It wasn't like I worked my way up in that industry. I did a completely lateral move in a different industry. And I would call up my colleagues in the post. I just doubled my salary because I left your company and went to another company.
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, all along there, I was trying to, you know, print my books and learn about copywriting and all that stuff. Like, during the lunch hour, I run to the post office with bubble envelopes with my VHS tapes.
That's work ethic. No, that's awesome. And it's a testament to you because you're right. I think, you know, we are suffering a generation that thinks things are owed to them for whatever reason, but Terry and I talked about this too. It's historical. You look at any great nation, name any of them, the Greeks, any of them, they get to a point where it's almost like you're saying that opiate kind of philosophy where everything is so good that there's nothing left to complain and work about.
Yeah.
So they end up themselves.
Except those took about 500 to 1,000 years. I mean, we've seen where everything's accelerating.
Totally. Like, we were just talking about this last night. We were talking about this last night. The weather's great now, so we had a little fire outside. We're sitting around talking, and we were just saying how, just the past, like, the acceleration in the past 20 to 30, 100 years, yes. I mean, massive, you look in 100 years. But even in the last 20 or 30. Yeah.
Look at business. I mean, you know, where was Amazon 5, 10 years ago, or these companies? The disruption, it's like Kodak or some of these other firms, Polaroid. It could take decades. Like, look at Sears and Roebuck, which was the Amazon of the 1900s. Yeah. I was just looking at old school pictures of how big their warehouse distribution centers were and everything like that. Yeah. I mean, their catalog went to 20 million people in a country that had 70 million people.
Isn't that crazy?
Imagine.
I still remember that catalog.
The thing was like this. Yeah. But now instead of it taking 5 or 6 years, 10 years or 15 years for a competitor to come in, it could be 6 months because of the dynamics in, digital computer, social media, Google has, they have a division where it's like moonshots. Like they don't want to see incremental improvement or something. They're trying to change, let's say, the dynamic of one industry from one move, you know, like Elon Musk, you know, he's trying to go to the stars, go to Mars, you know, for human, basic travel. I mean, these things where they took decades or now it's taking years, months, and it could be like, it sounds nuts, but my hope is I can create something that can go viral and you never know. Next thing you know, I got millions. You got millions
Absolutely.
Of followers.
Why not?
A couple of thousand people order my set. I had a guy from the Philippines who was telling me, a Filipino master just emailed me last night. And he's like, Marco, I just lost a friend of mine like 25 years ago. We used to talk about you all the time. We never did Kyokushin. We admired what Masayama did. By the way, can you, you know, how much can you discount your entire set? You know what I'm saying?
That's so awesome.
The guy just bought like all 27 of my videos last night.
That's
awesome. And it's, you know, imagine that times 1,000, right?
Well,
or 2,000. it's possible. Anything is possible. You can do that with a coffee shop, a donut shop. You know, you hear about Amazon destroying mom and pops, but now the mom and pops got to utilize that. You know, get on Instagram, you know, get Yelp, this create a different color, blah blah blah, and hype it up. There's so many things you can do. You know.
And you know, honestly, when I started seeing you coming back on the scene, I'm always looking, I want to promote people, and I want to promote Kyokushin, obviously, but, and I know you're not, you have a roots of Kyokushin, but you have all this other stuff. I want, that's part of the reason I wanted you on. I was like, I see him coming back, and I want to promote him, man. Like, this guy is a legend.
I'm actually kind of, I remember, I think my very first, I think I sent you a DM or something like that. I'm like, I don't even know. I don't know if this guy's going to know who I am. I'm just like some asshole sending me this DM that he knows how to fight. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
you
get a lot of those.
Certainly. So let me try to send them as much video as possible to show that maybe there's some validity to this. But that's so cool. I'm getting that vibe more and more from people. And in a strange way, look, I'm going to be 55. I'm training my ass off right now. Every bone, every joint, every muscle in my body is telling me, you know, hello, what happened? It's resting. So I'm trying to, I'm really exploring that. I'm looking at supplementation. I mean, I was
just going
to
ask you, what's your diet like and things of that nature?
Well, what I did, see, just like anything else from a progression standpoint, I didn't change what I ate. I cut it in half.
Oh, so you just cut the calories down.
I did portion control. Yeah. But now I am getting a little, like, what I have found that helped a lot is some fasting. Like, I do try to sometimes.
Yeah, I do too. Me too.
If I don't eat, let's say dinner at like 6 or 6:30, I'll do a good 14 to 16 hours, even though it might be a late breakfast. That has helped me significantly.
Me too. That's one of the things. Like, I turn 51 next month, and that's one of the things that
you whippersnapper.
So that's one of the things I really incorporate, and it just works. I don't know why, but it, you know, people are like, oh, I can't believe you skip breakfast. And I don't see it as skipping breakfast. It just works naturally for me. Yeah. I'm not hungry until
the reason I can do that though is I'll give you, it's taken me months because I do explore. At one point I used to sell a line of supplements back in the day.
Jesus, you've done everything.
I used it. There was this, one of them was like, they used this like a Native American root,
right,
which was supposed to be like for endurance and stuff like that. It was food form triathlon. So I loved the product. So I asked the guy, listen, can you give me a discount? I'll sell it along. So cool. I was like, it was always this crazy karate guy that sold my supplements and stuff. So I've worked up to now, I do 6 to 8 week, like I cycle on and off because I have this idea. I'm not a nutritionist, but like you have to detox for the supplements then to work, although some people believe that over time it'll work more. But I mean, I do use creatine.
Yeah, me too.
This all, you know, DHEA. You should look at the DHEA.
Yeah,
L-arginine, L-citrulline combined.
Yeah.
And I'm adding in the zinc, the magnesium.
Yeah.
Now, so what I do now in the morning is I try to prepare 5 or 6 mornings worth of a sport drink. That's more for endurance. It's got electrolytes and things like that for my bike ride.
Sure, yeah.
And then I just take the pills, slap them in my mouth. So over the 1.5 to 2 hour bike ride, I'm sipping. I have one bottle. I'm going to go to 2. So which means now I'm going to have the double amount of the electrolytes. And I do the electrolytes and the creatine. I was almost going to mix them together.
Yeah.
And then put them in, but I just do them, make sure I want to get the appropriate amounts in there.
Right.
So does that shit work? I think it does.
I think it does too. I feel the difference when I do it. And you, so we're very taking very, very similar things.
Yeah. That stuff is critical. I mean, the supplementation, I mean, you know, it's funny, but some athletes have horrendous diets because some of them don't have the time to look into that. But, you know, now with the age, you know, so the dieting, you know, I do try to eat well, but I love pizza. I love chocolate.
Well, you're half Italian.
I'll go an extra 5-10 miles on the bike. Just to eat that pizza. I'm going to have a pie tonight. My daughter, my middle daughter and I are obsessed with pizza.
I love it.
So it's cool. It's cool.
But man, whatever it's doing, it's working for you. Cause I mean, I've seen you with your shirt off lately and you look great. Like you do.
Thanks.
Jesus.
So
man,
I'm getting ready for the summer now. It's like, you know, I gained a, I went up, I just weighed myself. I'm like 164 this morning. I got up to 168.7.
What's your height? What's your height at?
I'm about, I say about, because that gives you, you know, I don't know if I hit 5'7". I've measured myself. I think I'm
okay, between 5'6 and 5'7". That's a good weight.
Listen, after losing almost 40 pounds, I went to my subsequent physical, the one I did in March. I had to do a backup one at the end of September. And when I got down to like 161. He goes, you know, according to this chart, technically you went from obese to overweight because you should be 159. I'm like, this guy like blew all the wind out of me. I was like, you know what I just did? You know what I mean? Just like, you know, I'm like in the best shape of my life. And I get it. Those charts are all, you know, skewed and everything like that. Yeah. But you know, I'm paranoid because now, you know.
Yeah, but you're carrying muscle too, though. Muscle's always going to be heavier than fat.
It's good. I guess, yeah. I like to use that excuse when
it's not. No, I know. I say that, but it's not, though. It's not.
You're probably right. So my kids, you know, when I got down, I did get down as low as 159. And, you know, my kids are like, Dad, you're starting to look anemic. I'm like, I'm doing something. Yeah, let me do what I got to do. Because I know once I touch weights, like my weight training now is it's ridiculous. I did a YouTube video on it. I mean, I'll be lucky if I do maybe two sets. I do a lightweight and a heavyweight because I feel like I'm serving two purposes for that. But if the workout lasts more than 10 or 15 minutes, like two or three times a week, but that stuff is like my muscles are just like, take to that stuff. Unbelievable. I feel like so good after that. So of course, what do? You start doing more of what you think you feel good about. And it's like, oh my God, I can't get up now. You know what I mean? I was doing the squats. I just did a set of 12 squats, you know, two sets of curls with 20 pounds and one with 50 pounds. That's my heavy, you know, and then some pullovers on the bench, you know, it's diagonal. You know, I love that because the concept of the stretching, you know, I don't know if that's true, but you know, for the breathing and everything like that, stretching the rib cage and so forth.
Yeah.
So, and then the plates, you know, the halo stuff. Yeah. Cause that was my first love. I did bodybuilding. I went from baseball. I loved Lou Ferrigno, pumping iron, all that stuff. Yeah. And then a little bit of Bruce Lee. And I said, you know what? See, I was already thinking back then, 12, 13. Why can't I be Bruce Lee and Lou Ferrigno? That dude, nobody's going to stop that dude. Right? So, boom, lifting.
And you did, martial arts. Were jacked back then. Holy shit. Man, those videos of you,
the weight training that we did was so bad. Like,
really?
Because I had all my buddies who didn't do martial arts, but they loved to weight train.
Yeah.
Our lifting, we used to lift for 5 or 6 hours. Like, best is benching, right? Oh, but you have to do decline, flat and incline bench. Yeah. Then you got to do close grip and wide grip, reverse grip, right? Next thing you know, you're doing like 15 exercises per body part.
Exactly.
And then it's like, you got tries, but you got different parts of the tries.
You got to hit all the heads.
Tries and exercises. But guys, man, this is crazy. So we just to blast metal and then lift for like 5 hours. And then I would go do karate after that at night for like three. That's probably why my body would start freezing up at some point. I'm like, I got to maybe lay off a little bit on the lifting. That was like my phenomenal strength training was the concept of, you know, weight training is great for martial arts unless it overrides your martial arts training. If you do less martial arts and do more weights, of course your martial art is going to be, in detriment. So, but now it's very scientific.
Everything's different now. I mean, even you're talking about supplements. I started taking a supplement called L-carnitine.
Okay.
I've taken a massive amount, like 5,000 milligrams before workout. Because my problem was I used to get a lot of lactic acid buildup on endurance stuff. So you get a lot of lactic acid buildup. And since I've been taking that almost immediately, I don't get it anymore. I get way more muscle endurance.
Yeah, I got to try that. I have it sitting on my shelf. I never took that because L-arginine and L-citrulline. And I thought everything was the building blocks. Like, I don't know how good a philosophy is, but it's like, you can't just take testosterone, but if you get the building blocks of it to help generate it to some degree, that was my philosophy. I've never gotten my test. I'm almost afraid to get my testosterone tested, but I figured my wife would say, listen, I think you have enough. So don't do anything. Please
leave it alone.
Do not do anything. Please. You know, I'm trying to lift the house up at some point or another. I don't know. I'm almost scared of that stuff because you start mussing around chemically with your body. I mean, I've seen some ugly shit in the long term. You know, it's almost like doing front thousands of front kicks with ankle weights, which everybody's done. I've done it, but never stop doing it.
You're gonna need
new knees at some point. I think your body's chemical system is it's the same way. You can really do some damage, in that respect. I could see for a temporary, like an illness or something, taking a steroid of some kind, but that stuff, I wouldn't even know where to begin,
There's a whole industry built around it now. It's like, these longevity doctors.
It's not even an afterthought. You have 50, low TRT, this and that.
Yeah.
I remember there was this guy, you ever see those ads? There was this guy, like an old looking doctor, genetics, whatever. Guy looked like he was 80 years old and he was fucking
just jacked.
I called once just to get some information. They were relentless for like 6 months. I'm like, Marco, you're gonna have a tire around your belly. I'm like, dude, I'm doing sit-ups and running, man. I'm okay right now. I don't have to, like, they want me to go on like a $2,000 a month, replacement therapy chemicals. I'm like, I was in my 40s at the time when I was looking. It's impressive, it's the ads, me studying ads. I'm like, wow, this is, didn't that guy die? I think his partner still runs the company. I think he had a heart attack or something. But I don't know, man. It's that whole industry is wild. It's really wild. The supplementation that, they're starting to make stuff look like, you can take it from syringes or it's coming from some lab. And then, I wrote this in my book. It's like you look at all of those supplements and everyone has a disclaimer. Said this may work with a good training
diet.
That's not to disparage the amount of work these guys do. Like, I was so obsessed with bodybuilding and just realized there were guys dying on stage, and then you look at the water, like they try to get their skin to onion level so you can see all the striations on them. Like, but you see, that's how you should think as a martial artist, right? With fighting and techniques and everything like that. But that's a bad, it's like being a really good criminal, you gotta watch out for those guys that are really obsessed with becoming good at things. You gotta make sure it's something, worthwhile, or philanthropic.
So what are your goals now coming up? What do you want to do with all this?
Listen, you want to create a situation where, and I realize the more I'm trying to create something where it's like a little bit on autopilot, like let's talk about the videos and the martial arts training and the digital stuff, because I see a lot of guys that are successful, but I know, once somebody knows that they think they got something, like I already see some guys that have been successful and they're trying to change their business model online because nothing lasts. Mm-hmm. Once something works, everybody jumps on that shit and you got to try to stay one step ahead. So, but how do you do that? I'm reverting a little bit to the old school, but I'm trying to learn about funnels, things of that. Like right now, my website, I just threw it up. I don't really have a website. My website is the e-commerce store. So you go to the site, whereas before I had clips and this and that, I have some testimonials.
And I'll make sure everything's in the description here too.
Oh, that's cool. So I'm trying to get to the point where here's where I want to be. 3 or 4 years from now, I have a decent portfolio of properties. Mm-hmm. I got a team helping me run. I am generating great rental income. I enjoy brokerage because it's like jujitsu. When I am dealing with a client that owns $1 billion worth of real estate, like, listen, right now I'm representing Columbia University. I'm selling a site for them. Wow. Montefiore Hospital, the cerebral palsy organization. These are my clients.
Wow.
I'm selling. I mean, I could never say, I'm just a kid from the Bronx, and I have these institutions that are using me to sell their commercial property. So I could never stop. I don't think I can ever stop doing that. Mm. My daughter hopes not, because she's on my team. So is my brother and my cousin. So that's like, I feel like I'm right now doing a dry run of my retirement. I have a great team I'm doing commercial real estate. My properties, I need more where they could be completely self-sufficient, but I envision a dojo where I'm going to train there myself. Like, Think about this. What if I sent out a text and I said, listen, guys, Friday at around 9:30, 10 o'clock, we're going to take my judo chart that has the 60 throws. We're going to do every throw 10 times. It might take us about 8, 9, 10 hours to do, but we're going to do that this weekend. Now, you know, and then whether I have a class or not, I just want to that's going to be in one of my properties where I can do stuff like
that. You have the ability.
And then, and then part of it is a studio where I'm going to start filming, shooting all my free content, maybe teach and do seminars. But you know what I'm going to be doing? Mm. When I wrote Phenomenal Endurance Training, I took my first ad out in Inside Kung Fu and I got my first check for $14.95 with the little coupon clipped out. The guy wrote his name and address on it. Oh man, if I sell a million of these, I can train all day. I got nothing to worry about. Right? Wasn't that always our goal?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like a monk. That's how I looked at. You know, you hear about Oyama going into the mountains. They said 3 years, but then I heard it was 2 18-month stints. And some guy did give him some rations. So it's how do you eat if you're training in the mountains all day by yourself? Like, I'm like, you know what? That would be so cool. Like, I used to tell my, you know, Hiyoki, is like, you know, I could just imagine like fighting in knockdown tournaments. He was chuckling when I would say this. Like, I'd have a gi for every tournament. I'd have a workout suit for every day of the week. I'm like, this guy. You know, it's almost like a Conor McGregorish type you know, philosophy there. But, you know, God bless. But I think it all comes down to I want to be able to train and still have a life where I can, like right now, I don't have to technically support my family. I mean, you know, my daughter worked at Goldman Sachs. Now she's at Ernst & Young. My other one works for me. My son's got a year to go. He's studying finance. He thinks he's going to be a combination of Gary Vee and Elon Musk. he's the one that's, you know, he helped me digitize my entire product line, set up the website, did the e-commerce. I use Equid. So now he can't stand it. You know, he's like, Mark, what do you think about if I change, like, Dad? So now I'm going in there, like all that stuff that I do with music and this, I'm doing that now because I'm relearning. Right. Like when I came out with the videos originally, I went out back then. I spent like $15,000 to be able to get a laser printer. The screens were like the size of a TV, like this thick. So I was designing my own catalogs. Mm-hmm. Like I would literally, I had a 50-page catalog once where I was starting to include knives. I'd worked out a deal with Everlast. Wow. And I was shooting the pictures. I was writing the type. And I'm like, it was not sustainable because I didn't have like an art department. I'm like,
sure.
Oh shit. I got to do another catalog, a 50 page catalog. You know, it took me like 100 hours of typesetting to do that shit, you know, but that's how obsessed I was. So to be able to me, I guess it comes down, I want to be able to wake up and train now, but nobody bothered me. So, that's not asking for too much, is it?
Yeah.
That's not asking too much, you know, but you know, 2 dogs, 3 kids, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I saw that one clip on your Instagram where you called you're like looking away and you called your dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
That shit is so old. I got 2 poodles. They're like 10 pounds each. I mean, I saw those things. I'm like, man, that's, I always want, you know, that was pretty cool. I mean,
that's my day every day.
That's kind of silly. I remember seeing that on your Instagram. You know, you just call their name. You see them flying out from behind. I love it.
All right, my friend.
Man. I can probably go on for about 10 hours. I'm sorry.
This has been amazing. I didn't want to eat up too much of your time. I feel like it's been like an hour and a half. I don't want to, I feel bad, but you're an inspiration, honest to God, man, on so many levels, from martial arts to just on your entrepreneurship, everything. You're an amazing gentleman.
I appreciate it.
It's been an absolute honor.
Thank you. And it's so cool, you know, what you're doing. I hope it blows up. I will help in any way that I can too. You know, the foundation, the Kyokushin Foundation, we can't not succeed. We can't not succeed. Right.
I hope
you have to got to keep pushing. Yeah.
Any final words for your fans and people out there?
Listen, I just, you know, when I get, like I said, when I get an email where somebody says, Marco, like somebody just sent me a DM. He's like, I bought your knockout video. I saw it hundreds and hundreds of times. I'm like, that's impossible, man. You know, it's really a strange feeling. I'll tell you one more anecdote. Like, I was on a sales trip, you know, with my firm, national company, billion-dollar firm. I'm speaking to, we're in a hotel in Hawaii, right? Mm-hmm. That was like the sales trip for the top earners and stuff. So I'm like drinking there. Some one of the waiters or something comes flying over. He goes, "Hey, this is for you." I'm like, he's like, "Oh, so you ever see that Coming to America? You know, where he's on the date," and he's like, "So this guy's so like my boss is like, what's that all about?" He's the guy told me he was watching my videos. He opened up a kickboxing school on the island and everything, because I was like, just get away from me. You know what I mean? That's so humbling when I hear that stuff. And you know, it's just amazing to be able to take a passion and you know bring it to another level. And that's what I hope to do. I got a lot of time to make up, and thanks to guys like yourself acknowledging it, it's humbling. I mean, I don't want to sound cliche-ish, but it's like, wow, you know what I mean? I appreciate the time.
I'm the one that's humbled by it, and I'm looking forward to checking on your success coming up. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you.